Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So we'll continue reading this chapter on Right Mind in the Book of Right Mindfulness, Chapter 6, Structure of Breath Meditation. Reading suttas interspersed therein. And also, there's a couple of passages that I'll read twice, some very good points that Lungpur has highlighted here. So he starts out referring to something previous, the explanation of the fourth tetrad, which says, "He who sees with discernment the abandoning of greed and distress is one who watches carefully with equanimity." So then he goes on, similarly with the fourth explanation, the abandoning of greed and distress indicates the successful performance of an aspect of the standard description of the establishing of mindfulness, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. This, too, is a necessary part of breath meditation. Only when you can successfully abandon this sort of greed and distress, even if only temporarily, can you stay focused on the breath for any length of time. The act of subduing this greed and distress may require either equanimity or the exertion of fabrication. I'm actually not quite sure what that.
That's Ajahn Jeff's translation of this is that's kind of a soft phrase in the it's in the definition of right effort, I think, or in the definition of the path to success or for basis of success.
Or exertion of fabrication. But when the greed and distress are successfully abandoned, you can simply look on them with equanimity. So here too, the discourse is offering you a choice as to where to focus your attention while you stay with the breath. If you want, even at the most basic stage of actually staying focused on the breath, you can note the presence of equanimity, which is one of the seven factors of awakening, which in turn is one of the themes of remaining focused on mental qualities in and of themselves, as the aspect of the process you want to observe. You see that skillful qualities, such as equanimity, can be made to arise in areas where they may not have functioned before. This provides both encouragement on the path and practical insight into the processes of cause and effect within the mind. As for the question of why careful attention to in and out breaths would be classed as a type of feeling in the second explanation, remember that Samyutta Nikaya, Chapter 22, Sutta 79, describes the role of fabrication as an element in the actual experience of every aggregate, including feeling. And I'll read that sutta. The sutta is called Being Devoured. Atsavati. Bhikkhus, those ascetics and Brahmins who recollect their manifold past abodes, all recollect the five aggregates subject to clinging or a certain one among them. What five? When recollecting thus, bhikkhus, I had such form in the past. It is just form that one recollects. When recollecting, I had such a feeling in the past. It is just feeling that one recollects. When recollecting, I had such a perception in the past. It is just perception that one recollects. When recollecting, I had such volitional formations in the past. It is just volitional formations that one recollects. When recollecting, I had such consciousness in the past. It is just consciousness that one recollects. And why, bhikkhus, do you call it form? It is deformed, bhikkhus, therefore it is called form. Deformed by what? Deformed by cold, deformed by heat, deformed by hunger, deformed by thirst, deformed by contact with flies, mosquitoes, wind, sun and serpents. It is deformed, bhikkhus, therefore it is called form. And Ajahn Jeff translates that as afflicted. It is afflicted, therefore it is called form.
And it's also, I think it's sort of a play on words as well.
It is. Bhikkhu Bodhi has a note. He says, Rupati tiko bhikkhave tasma rupanti vuchati. I have tried, though clumsily, to capture the subtle wordplay of the Pali, which capitalizes on the apparent correspondence between the verb rupati and the noun rupa. Etymologically, the two are not related. Rupati is a passive verb from the root rup, to break, injure, or spoil, or to suffer violent or racking pain.
Like how Brahmins would define words. They would just like show sort of basically using really bad puns.
I think the rest of the aggregates, there's less wordplay here. And why, bhikkhus, do you call it feeling? It feels. Maybe not. It feels, bhikkhus, therefore it is called feeling. And there's a note on that one too. The note is, the commentary says, it is feeling itself that feels, not another person. Okay. And what does it feel? It feels pleasure, it feels pain, it feels neither pleasure nor pain. It feels, bhikkhus, therefore it is called feeling. And why, bhikkhus, do you call it perception? It perceives, bhikkhus, therefore it is called perception. And what does it perceive? It perceives blue, it perceives yellow, it perceives red, it perceives white. It perceives, bhikkhus, therefore it is called perception. And why, bhikkhus, do you call them volitional formations? They construct and condition, bhikkhus, therefore they are called volitional formations. And there's a note there. Unfortunately, English is a poor medium for capturing the interconnections of this sentence of Pali with the object, sankatang, the verb, abhisankaronti, and the subject, sankara, all derived from the same stem. We might have rendered it, they construct the constructed, therefore they are called volitional constructions, though this would bear certain connotations quite alien to the original. And what is the conditioned that they construct? They construct conditioned form as form. They construct conditioned feeling as feeling. They construct conditioned perception as perception. They construct conditioned volitional formations as volitional formations. They construct conditioned consciousness as consciousness. They construct the conditioned, bhikkhus, therefore they are called volitional formations. And why, bhikkhus, do you call it consciousness? It cognizes, bhikkhus, therefore it is called consciousness. And what does it cognize? It cognizes sour, it cognizes bitter, it cognizes pungent, it cognizes sweet, it cognizes sharp, it cognizes mild, it cognizes salty, it cognizes bland. It cognizes, bhikkhus, therefore it is called consciousness. The note says, these are the eight flavors. The explanation of vijnana here is very similar to that of sanya, the difference being only in the type of sense object they cognize. Samantapasadaka explains that the difference in object highlights a difference in their cognitive functions. Perception is analyzed by way of the eye door because it is evident in grasping the appearance and shape of the object. Consciousness is analyzed by way of the tongue door because it can grasp particular distinctions in an object even when there is no appearance and shape. Therein, bhikkhus, the instructed noble disciple, reflects thus, I am now being devoured by form. In the past too, I was devoured by form in the very same way that I am now being devoured by present form. If I were to seek delight in future form, then in the future too I shall be devoured by form in the very same way that I am now being devoured by present form. Having reflected thus, he becomes indifferent towards past form, he does not seek delight in future form, and he is practicing for dispassion towards present form, for its fading away and cessation. He reflects thus, I am now being devoured by feeling, I am now being devoured by perception, I am now being devoured by volitional formations, I am now being devoured by consciousness. In the past too, I was devoured by consciousness in the very same way that I am now being devoured by present consciousness. If I were to seek delight in future consciousness, then in the future too I shall be devoured by consciousness in the very same way that I am now being devoured by present consciousness. Having reflected thus, he becomes indifferent towards past consciousness, he does not seek delight in future consciousness, and he is practicing for revulsion towards present consciousness for its fading away and cessation. What do you think, bhikkhus? Is form permanent or impermanent? Is feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir. Is that which is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. Is that which is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself? No, Venerable Sir. Therefore, bhikkhus, any kind of form whatsoever, any kind of feeling whatsoever, any kind of perception whatsoever, any kind of volitional formations whatsoever, any kind of consciousness whatsoever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all consciousness should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. This is called, bhikkhus, a noble disciple who dismantles and does not build up, who abandons and does not cling, who scatters and does not amass, who extinguishes and does not kindle. Apt, kindle. And what is it that he dismantles and does not build up? He dismantles form and does not build it up. He dismantles feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, and does not build it up. And what is it that he abandons and does not cling to? He abandons form and does not cling to it. He abandons feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, and does not cling to it. And what is it that he scatters and does not amass? He scatters form and does not amass it. He scatters feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, and does not amass it. And what is it that he extinguishes and does not kindle? He extinguishes form and does not kindle it. He extinguishes feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, and does not kindle it. Seeing thus, bhikkhus, the instructed noble disciple experiences revulsion towards form, revulsion towards feeling, revulsion towards perception, revulsion towards volitional formations, revulsion towards consciousness. Experiencing revulsion, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. This is called, bhikkhus, a noble disciple who neither builds up nor dismantles, but who abides having dismantled, who neither abandons nor clings, but who abides having abandoned, who neither scatters nor amasses, but who abides having scattered, who neither extinguishes nor kindles, but who abides having extinguished. And what is it, bhikkhus, that he neither builds up nor dismantles, but abides having dismantled? He neither builds up nor dismantles form, but abides having dismantled it. He neither builds up nor dismantles feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, but abides having dismantled it. And what is it that he neither abandons nor clings to, but abides having abandoned? He neither abandons nor clings to form, but abides having abandoned it. He neither abandons nor clings to feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, but abides having abandoned it. And what is it that he neither scatters nor amasses, but abides having scattered? He neither scatters nor amasses form, but abides having scattered it. He neither scatters nor amasses feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, but abides having scattered it. And what is it that he neither extinguishes nor kindles, but abides having extinguished? He neither extinguishes nor kindles form, but abides having extinguished it. He neither extinguishes nor kindles feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, but abides having extinguished it. When, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is thus liberated in mind, the devas together with Indra, Brahma, and Pajapati pay homage to him from afar. Homage to you, O thoroughbred man. Homage to you, O highest among men. We ourselves do not directly know, dependent upon what you meditate. So that's the entire sutta, and it's just the Buddha driving the point home, the five aggregates, letting go of the five aggregates. If there's any questions, comments.
Just one comment about Bhikkhu Bodhi's, we kind of mentioned it before, but just to remind people his use of the word revulsion. Right?
Yeah, he's not using that anymore. Yeah,
he's back to disenchantment.
Okay. So that's a good note for the recording. That's revulsion is now disenchantment. That's I knew he had changed it. I couldn't remember what he had changed it to.
It's been a while now. Of course, that's been out in some years. Been out for quite many years. But we stopped using revulsion.
Too many people were experiencing revulsion to his use of revulsion.
Also, it'd even be interesting to see what he translated as indifferent.
Oh, okay. There might be a note on that.
2279?
Yeah. There was a question.
Could you give the number of the sutta again?
That Samyutta Nikaya, it's chapter 22, sutta 79. The second explanation here implicitly focuses on this fact. We'll go back to the previous sentence. Samyutta Nikaya 22:79 describes the role of fabrication as an element in the actual experience of every aggregate, including feeling. The second explanation here implicitly focuses on this fact, noting that by paying attention to the breath, you actualize the experience of feelings connected to the breath that would otherwise remain only potential. In other words, the act of attention is part and parcel of the feeling it fabricates. This explanation also offers an important practical insight. The best way to maintain the sense of pleasure coming from careful attention to the breath is to keep attending to the breath. If you switch your focus totally to the pleasure will lose its foundation and soon dissolve away. In these ways, the four explanations offer some important insights into understanding the 16 steps. In particular, they show that the 16 steps don't necessarily follow a straight linear sequence. Instead, each tetrad can serve as an object of focus simultaneously with any of the other tetrads. As you practice breath meditation, you can remain focused on the second, third, or fourth tetrad while continuing to remain focused on the breath. And that part is highlighted, so I'll reread this passage. It's an important point. The best way to maintain the sense of pleasure coming from careful attention to the breath is to keep attending to the breath. If you switch your focus totally to the pleasure will lose its foundation and soon dissolve away. In these ways, the four explanations offer some important insights into understanding the 16 steps. In particular, they show that the 16 steps don't necessarily follow a straight linear sequence. Instead, each tetrad can serve as an object of focus simultaneously with any of the other tetrads. As you practice breath meditation, You can remain focused on the second, third, or fourth tetrad while continuing to remain focused on the breath. For example, there are times when you find it most helpful to focus on how the breath is giving rise to feelings of rapture and pleasure, to the way these feelings, as mental fabrications along with the perceptions you're employing around the breath, are influencing the mind, and to how you can calm that influence. This would be an example of focusing on the second tetrad while simultaneously remaining focused on the first. At other times, you'll find it more useful to see which ways the mind is in or out of balance, too sluggish, for instance, or too scattered, and then use the breath to bring it more into balance. This would be an example of focusing on the third tetrad while still focused on the first. And at other times, you will want to observe how you can develop the dispassion that will enable you to let go of any external preoccupations that threaten to pull you away from the breath. This would turn attention to the fourth tetrad while staying focused on the first. The possibility of combining tetrads in this way is confirmed by noting how the Buddha's four explanations can be mapped against the standard formula of the first establishing of mindfulness. One remains focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. The reference to the breath as a body among bodies in the first explanation corresponds to the phrase body in and of itself in the formula. The reference to careful attention in the second explanation relates to the practice of remaining focused, described in the formula. The reference to mindfulness and alertness in the third explanation is an obvious reference to two of the qualities that, according to the formula, are brought to the act of remaining focused on the body in and of itself, being alert and mindful. And the reference to abandoning greed and distress in the fourth explanation is a direct reference to the act of subduing greed and distress with reference to the world, which also is an aspect of the third mental quality brought to the act of remaining focused on the body in and of itself, ardency. In other words, the Buddha is showing how the activity of the first establishing of mindfulness, and this establishing, like all the establishings, is basically an activity, contains aspects of all four establishings, any of which can be taken as a frame of reference. The practical implication here, as we have noted, is that the shift in focus from one frame of reference to another doesn't require you to switch to a new meditation practice. It simply turns attention to another aspect of what you're already doing. This is like mastering a new piece on the piano. Once you've got the notes down and it's time to listen to how your playing sounds, you don't stop playing to listen more clearly. You keep on playing, again and again, while you listen to the nuances of your touch and phrasing and to the overall thoughts and emotions you're conveying. This is what allows you both to develop more skill and to discover new things in the music. Because these four establishings are the themes of right concentration, and because the mindfulness of breathing developed by the 16 steps is termed a type of concentration, we would thus expect the four tetrads to offer four different perspectives on the single process of how right concentration develops. And when we compare each of the tetrads with the descriptions of the stages of concentration, we find that they actually do correspond. This correspondence plays out both on the macro level, each tetrad corresponds in its own way to the overall map of the levels of right concentration, and on the micro level, each gives a specific direction to what to do each time you sit down to develop right concentration. First, on the macro level, so here we're gonna go to the macro level, and micro we're not going to get to this evening, but we'll read this last paragraph and then end with a sutta. First, on the macro level, the first tetrad, discerning the breath as long or short, sensitizing yourself to the entire body and calming bodily fabrication, the in and out breathing, describes the process of breath meditation up through the fourth jhana. You start by maintaining focus on the breath, and then, as you enter the first jhana, develop a full body awareness. The breath grows progressively more refined and calm as you move through the jhanas until you reach the fourth, at which stage in and out breathing stops. And this is highlighted in another Samyutta Sutta, Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 36, Sutta 11. It's called Alone. Then a certain bhikkhu approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Here, Venerable Sir, while I was alone in seclusion, a reflection arose in my mind thus. Three feelings have been spoken of by the Blessed One: pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. These three feelings have been spoken of by the Blessed One. But the Blessed One has said, whatever is felt is included in suffering. Now, with reference to what was this stated by the Blessed One? Good, good, bhikkhu. These three feelings have been spoken of by me: pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. These three feelings have been spoken of by me, and I also have said, whatever is felt is included in suffering. That has been stated by me with reference to the impermanence of formations. That has been stated by me with reference to formations being subject to destruction, to formations being subject to vanishing, to formations being subject to fading away, to formations being subject to cessation, to formations being subject to change. Then, bhikkhu, I have also taught the successive cessation of formations. For one who has attained the first jhana, speech has ceased. For one who has attained the second jhana, thought and examination have ceased. For one who has attained the third jhana, rapture has ceased. For one who has attained the fourth jhana, in-breathing and out-breathing have ceased. For one who has attained the base of the infinity of space, the perception of form has ceased. For one who has attained the base of the infinity of consciousness, the perception pertaining to the base of the infinity of space has ceased. For one who has attained the base of nothingness, the perception pertaining to the base of the infinity of consciousness has ceased. For one who has attained the base of neither perception nor non-perception, the perception pertaining to the base of nothingness has ceased. For one who has attained the cessation of perception and feeling, perception and feeling have ceased. For a bhikkhu whose taints are destroyed, lust has ceased, hatred has ceased, delusion has ceased. Then, bhikkhu, I have also taught the successive subsiding of formations. For one who has attained the first jhana, speech has subsided, and so on to the cessation of perception and feeling. For a bhikkhu whose taints are destroyed, lust has subsided, hatred has subsided, delusion has subsided. And also the same for tranquilized. First jhana, speech has been tranquilized, and so on. One whose taints are destroyed, lust has been tranquilized, hatred has been tranquilized, delusion has been tranquilized. So some other aspects, not so stock descriptions of the jhanas and the states of concentration. Any comments or questions?
Since the chapter's been broken up a little bit, and since we are low on time, did he describe what the tetrads were earlier in that chapter? Because I've quite forgotten what they are, so when they're referenced, I can't recall.
Yeah, the tetrads are the first four steps of Anapanasati.
Okay.
That's known as the first tetrad, which is corresponds to mindfulness of the body and the four foundations of mindfulness. Okay. The second tetrad of Anapanasati is starting with feelings of rapture and then going on to happiness and then the subsiding of those. That's corresponds to the second foundation of mindfulness. So that's called the feeling tetrad.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third, the steps 11, the steps 9, 10, 11, 12 in Anapanasati would be correspond to the third foundation of mindfulness, and then the last four steps corresponds to the fourth. So it's kind of pariyati. This is a pariyati. So it's like a lot of lists. It's trying to find how to practically apply it, which he went into very well in some of those last paragraphs, like a lot of information and then how to practically apply it. And if Paul had any comments on practical application.
I just have kind of a question for clarification about the equating of the first four steps to the first, or to the four jhanas, and particularly as it, like the fourth step of tranquilizing the breath, as it relates, you know, basically saying that, I didn't quite figure out if he was saying it, but it sounded like he was saying that that's equivalent to fourth jhana, or was he just saying that it could be developed to the point?
I would say that it would be, I don't know what he said, I can't remember what he said, but I would say that it can be developed to the point.
To the point, yeah. Just because
as opposed to, it
is equated
as a straight, as a straight equation.
Yeah. It would seem to kind of undermine the, you know, the practical use of it if you were limiting it.
Well, that's also why these tetrads are all the different aspects of Anapanasati are, you know, they feed back and forth, and cross pollinate all the time.
he never specifically says that as far as like the jhanas equating to certain steps,
mm-hmm.
but it seems to be kind of
it's trying to relate
implicit
them.
Or related.
Well,
somehow.
It's very, very much a commentarial equation. That's a standard explanation.
In the previous sutta, the Buddha is describing like perception in terms of, you know, perceiving different colors, like the eye door, and then described consciousness as cognizing like different tastes. And I didn't quite, they almost seem like the same thing but slightly different. I'm wondering if anybody could offer some more clarification. I didn't quite.
Well, that was what the footnote that Bhikkhu Bodhi gave trying to clarify that. That's a bit. I think one of the in the footnote, what Bhikkhu Bodhi says is that the I think it's a commentarial position or trying to get the explanation is that the with perception, you're taking it's using a visual, the base of sight as the example, because perception usually relies on some kind of form of some sort, because it also relies on memory, although that doesn't 100% true, but in terms of predominantly. Whereas consciousness is much more of an internal thing, and all these distinctions of taste that it uses as an example are not so concrete. They're not concrete, so that there's the function of consciousness is much more of a mental, much more relying on a mental distinctions that one cognizes. And perception is relying more on something that's a bit more solid or substantial. And the reality, of course, is that whether it's perception or whether it's consciousness, you're still relying on all six sense bases. But in terms of an example, trying to give a distinction, then there's a bit more solidity to the perceptual realm as opposed to the consciousness realm.
I think, I can't remember who it was, there was something where I was reading, it might have been in one of Analio's books, that he was analyzing that whole discussion and basically said what distinctions there are of very fineness.
Yes.
A bit confusing.
I think it's confusing to the commentator, and it's been, you know, it's right. Confusing to the commentators. And but I think it's also you know, that sense of remembering the function of perception as relying on memory and feeling, and that's that sense of perception relying on this aspect of memory and association.
That's why I'm confused about it. When I think of consciousness as being, that would be more concrete, be like the color black or.
Well, see, that is the, no, that's a function of memory.
But, well, perceiving it like is much more like, because perception is more of a, like that's a microphone stand, I know that.
Yeah, but the only way you know that is because you see
from
memory of seeing it, and it's and the particular shape and color gives you a visual cue in memory that you associate, and then so that's the function of perception, whereas yes. Consciousness is not formula, it's more. Whenever the Buddha defines consciousness, he always defines it as the consciousness of the particular sense door, so that it's something a bit more fundamental than even the associations and memories.
But that's why my confusion is, you said the perception being more solid and foundational, whereas consciousness.
Well, consciousness is a bit is more say immaterial or more it's not rely, it's just there's a bit more of a what it is it's conscious of a particular sense stimulation. And then it weaves it together. That's another function of consciousness, is that weaving together.
Could you say it's not objectifying?
It's not object. Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. It's not creating an object.
So would it be safe to assume like perception is kind of like identifying, whereas consciousness is more like applying?
Let's see. Identifying is a good way of describing perception.
Consciousness may be more close to cognizing.
Well, yeah. I mean, cognizing. But it's a lot more fundamental, really. It's a lot more fundamental that sense of. It weaves it together, it's also always important to sort of that these five khandhas are conjoined; they are not disjoined. They're working together, and of course that's part of the cognition, is that weaving together the different. Aspects of our experience, feeling, perception, thoughts. But they're only helpful I don't think you can't really separate them out completely, and they're helpful as aspects of function, so that we can. Just as in that sutta where the Buddha is pulling it apart and pulling it apart, so that we can get a feel for non-self, because that's another aspect of, say, of consciousness, is that well, like the whole package really, is that it constructs a sense of self out of it. That's so fundamental. That sense of the I, that sense of this is me, this is mine, this is my body, my feelings, as opposed to these are arising and ceasing, and working together, functioning together, but a lot of the effort that we put into say analyzing that's its purpose, is to help deconstruct that sense of self, the self position that is so deeply ingrained.
He starts off the sutta by saying any ascetics and Brahmins who see their past lives, they all equate it as this was me as in that past life, yet all they're seeing is a different configuration of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. Right. I think that's interesting. He starts it off that way and then describes all five aggregates and then jumps into the giving the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the Sutta on Not Self, and just pounding it in.
One last comment. The five clinging aggregates, Panchupadana Khanda, could also be translated as the five piles of fuel.
Yes.
And there's imagery given of people heaping wood on a fire, like describing these things. And I thought that sutta was, it just made so much of it.
Yes, definitely taking the fuel off.
Annamayam dhamma kathaya sadhu karam tadamase sa.